Tonight on Arena, artist Sean Scully and critic Kelly Grovier on their new book, On the Line, Conversations with Sean Scully. And Gavin Quinn and Pan Pan Theatre make a book club for their theatre festival show. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Born in Dublin in 1945, Sean Scully is an internationally celebrated painter, sculptor and photographer. His work is held in key museum collections worldwide. He has twice been nominated for the Turner Prize and he has exhibited at the Venice Biennale. A new book, On the Line, Conversations with Sean Scully, is sculpted from hours of phone calls that Sean had with art critic Kelly Grovier during lockdown. Stunning illustrations of Scully's work are used as touchstones in the book, and he talks about growing up, becoming an artist, and the losses and light he has found on the way. Delighted to be joined this evening on the programme by Sean Scully in New York and Kelly Grovier in Belfast. I don't know if either of you, I doubt you did hear the previous item about Michelangelo's David being covered up at the Dubai Expo or not, but I'll start with you, Sean. Had you heard this story? What do you think of the idea that David should be covered up at any exhibition?
I don't really have a strong opinion about it, but you know that they are in a very strong, rigid moral code living society. So my question would be, what's it doing there in the first place?
Fair enough. Well, we'll ask them to answer that if we get a chance. What do you think, Kelly? Have you heard about this controversy and what have you been hearing about it?
I hadn't heard the controversy, and so I would have been interested to hear the arguments. It's hard for me to imagine how anyone is uplifted by that kind of censorship, but I'd like to hear the rationale before I make a firm opinion.
Yeah, no, fair enough. There was a whole discussion about it beforehand, but that is not what we're here to talk about. I just wanted to get your initial reaction to that. We're here to talk about the book, On the Line, Conversations with Sean Scully. You first met at the Ulster Museum in 2009. You've remained friends ever since, and the result is this wonderful set of conversations, wonderful set of interviews and amazing illustrations that are in the book. Was there something, even at that initial meeting, Sean, that struck you about Kelly and what he said about your work that you thought, yeah, this is somebody I'd actually like to continue a conversation with art about?
There was something that struck me about Kelly, and that was the way he looked, because he looked like he was 20 years old, and I wondered what he was doing there. Because he kept accompanying us when we had tea in the afternoon at the Ulster Museum. And I didn't know anything about him. I thought he looked very sweet and nice, like a lovely, fresh-faced undergraduate. And it was only when I read his writing that I realized what a forceful and eloquent master of words he is.
So, Kelly, there you were, a young fella in Sean's eyes at that point in the Ulster Museum in 2009. I think it's safe to say you weren't a fresh out of university student at that point in your career, for sure. Was there something that had that angelic, sweet young boy look on your face that Sean has described? Was there something in the work that had caused that, do you think?
Maybe. I mean, I think there is something about Sean's work that brings out perhaps a sweetness of reflection in you. But there's also something that brings out a depth and poignancy and soulfulness. And it's certainly something that's alive in all of his paintings and is brought even more alive when you hear him talk about the life that led up to the creation of these works.
And that is precisely what you give us in the book between the two of you, and the way it's laid out. At times, Kelly, you provide us a kind of a documentary, if you like, or you lead us from one question to the next, and then we have direct quotes from Sean and from those conversations. particularly striking, Sean, for me was that reference that you give to your early life in Dublin, fairly straitened circumstances, I think it's safe to say, before they moved to London when you were four. No silver spoon, nothing in your background that particularly pointed to the artist that you would become. But a few things you pointed out that I was really struck by. A bicycle, a blue bicycle. What is your memory of this blue bicycle and how far back does it go?
Well, you know, we came over from Ireland. I think I was three or four, so maybe it was in 48. And I believe my aunt, who was the only one who had any money at all, because we were starving, bought me that bike. And to me, it was so exotic. I don't know why I was so profoundly affected by it. Had a little trunk at the back where you could put something. That's very important for kids, you know, because kids like to have secret things or precious things. So I'd put something in there, drive around all over the streets off the Old Kent Road, completely unsupervised, which, of course, couldn't happen today. So it was wild in a certain sense, and it gave me a great access to adventure.
But your memories, you speak specifically about the blueness of this bicycle, and people who know your paintings will know that blueness is a fairly important colour right across the work. Are your memories particularly visual in that respect? Or is that how you remember things in that way?
Well, I remember things in lots of ways. You know, I don't think you can simplify a human being into somebody who remembers things this way or that way. We're complex. But the colour did have a profound effect on me, and I always loved that cerulean blue. Here's another imagery, though. At the other end of Madrid Street where we lived was a barber's pole,
yes.
A rough one. And, you know, the barber's pole was made out of the symbolism of blood and bandages, because that's what the barbers were originally. And so I had the bicycle, which gave me access to travel my own little way. And at the other end of the street where my dad worked part-time was a barber's pole. I think that's very interesting symbolically.
Well, there are certain symbolisms with the barber's pole, but we can't help but refer to the fact that we are talking about the red and white stripes, even though it's going around a cylinder. And obviously, in the case of your paintings, we're talking about a rectangular or a square canvas that we would be looking at. But those bars became so essential to how your work would develop.
Yeah, they've been with me the whole way, or as they say in China. The stripe has been a good wife to me, a very faithful wife is the way they described it. They're humorous people.
Kelly, in terms of those stripes, those bars that make up Sean's work to a large extent, there are other elements in there obviously as well. What do you think, what does that tell us about what Sean Scully was doing back in the 1970s, I suppose, when he was kind of blowing things apart in the art world with those stripes?
Yeah, well, he engages with the language of the stripe, which is something obviously that already had some practitioners in minimalism and earlier in Mondrian. But as you say, he blows it apart. He makes it his own. He takes it, and he takes it from being something that is purely art historical, something that is refined and part of a members-only story if people don't necessarily feel invited to the narrative of art history. And he makes it emotional and personal, and he loads it with a kind of intensity and a kind of profundity that makes it a completely different vocabulary altogether, and one that is no longer mathematical, it's no longer about geometry, and it's no longer about simplicities. Instead, it's about, well, all of life. And it's about balance, and it's about harshness of light, and Taft of Color, and it's really, you can find all of life in those stripes.
Let's talk to the specifics of one of the works, and this work is reproduced in the book, and you, Sean, kindly give us permission to tweet these images tonight so that those listening to us can actually see the image we're talking about. And if you want to look at that image now, Wall of Light is part of that series, and it's called Desert Night. It's a work from 1999, and we'll tweet that on our own Twitter handle, which is at RTE Arena. So the blues, Sean, are very present in this particular work. Maybe you just describe a little bit. I love the background to where you were when you made this piece and how it formed itself in your mind.
Yes, it's very interesting that, you know, people often say that art is redemption. Well, we went to Las Vegas to see the boxing, and we were invited, you know, so that's where we went. People talk about Las Vegas as an American masterpiece. I think it's an American nightmare. And it's a black hole where they can chuck all the electricity in the state of Nevada down and waste it as it twinkles away to its demise. And I couldn't stand it. The place was driving me up the wall. And so we went out to the desert and Fire Valley. And what amazed me was the floor of the desert. I'd never noticed that before. It was a beautiful drawing where all the creatures are walking around at night. There must be 50 species of creature on desert floors. And on the way back, as the sun was going down, it was playing off on the rocks. So I decided, as an act of self-salvation, to remember that and ignore Las Vegas. And as soon as I got back, I made this big homage to the memory of that drive and that time in the desert. And I called it Wall of Light, Desert Night. And it reflected all the blacks and purples and grays and dark blues and dying colors that rest on the rocks on the side of the highway.
And how would you say, in terms of over the years, the lines, the demarcation between the stripes or the blocks, that has changed? The blocks themselves have changed in terms of the looseness of the shapes. What point would you say the stripe has been developed to in that work from 1999?
Well, you know, in the Wall of Light paintings, I broke with the idea of the stripe going from one side to the other of the painting, because I wanted to paint the relationships more, make the paintings more vulnerable and open in the spaces between the bars. And the spaces between the bars in the Wall of Light paintings tend to be very important indeed. And in fact, I've gone back to making some lately with brighter colors. So I would say that the Wall of Light paintings in particular, following the very physical paintings that had sculpted divisions and were real knockabout, almost working class, banged together, fine art. I think that the Wall of Light paintings make a much more kind of ideal world. They're less physically combative.
And in terms, Kelly, to go to you, because this is what you do in the book that we're talking about, On the Line, Conversations with Sean Scully. Sean gives us statements and answers. His side of the conversation is given in just the way he's given us that explanation of that painting. But then you often give us context around that. How emblematic is that Wall of Light series of paintings in terms of Sean's work, would you say?
Sean's work is a work in progress. It evolves, and I think there is no one snapshot that speaks for the whole. I think, as Sean's saying, that there is something about the Wall of Light series that is a kind of ideal in a sense, and I think there is a certain viewer who might find it a friendly place to start. But there's much to be seen and much to be appreciated right across the work. It embodies, though, you know, important journeys Sean has taken. It begins its life in Mexico in a watercolor he made on the beach there, and it absorbs into its surface all of the trials and triumphs that came before it. So Wall of Light is a kind of a nice pivot point in the career between early and late. But there's great stuff on either side.
In fact, I'll go to something which the identity, even though you were only in this part of the world, in Dublin, Sean, for 4 years at the beginning of your life, it would seem that Irish identity, according to what you're saying in the book, in fact, it has become stronger over time. How do you think, or why do you think that has happened?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And one can never answer it accurately. One can only hypothesize or surmise, but I'm very attracted to Ireland. I'm very in love with it in a certain way. And when I'm there, I get along with people fantastically well. That could be said, though, of San Antonio, too, where I just got back from, where I had a great time. So I think that there's a certain kind of openness in Irish people, and a lack of judgment, I would say. And I feel very good in that. And it's of course, it is the most beautiful place in the world in a certain way, like parts of Sweden or Finland. But that's not it. That's not the reason that I love it so much. I think the reason I love it so much is because there's something in me that's ancient and contemporary all at the same time. And you know that I went to Newgrange, world's oldest building, greatest plumbing, still works. And, you know, on the outside of it, it's adorned with abstract art that's 5,000 years old. So that Paleolithic period is very close to my heart.
I'm going to tweet another image at this point, Sean, and it's a detail from Arran 2005. And of course, what we're looking at here are those wonderful stone walls that we get so many of in the west of Ireland. Maybe not quite as old as Newgrange, but there's an ancient quality in these as well. What appeals to you about those stone walls?
Ah, well, I wrote on that. You know, what I love about them is their personality. And they're all made in a different style. So I'm very fond of the idea of the elevated proletariat. That's one of the reasons that I had such a great time in Mexico, because I think poor people have this ability to elevate themselves with not very much. And the Mexicans do it with aggressive color. And they paint their houses with these bright, vulgar colors that have abutments according to how long that particular color lasts. I love that kind of stuff. And on the west of Ireland, you know, you have these walls that are built to stop the land from being pulled off into the sea by the wind. And that allows them to make grass, which is of course made out of sand and mixing it in with plant material that makes earth. And they have a function. Yeah, they're protecting a field, but there's something inexplicably beautiful about them, because no one can really explain why they are all made in a signature style that's different one to the other.
And in fact, even as I'm looking at that image now, and it's up on our Twitter page at RTE Arena, I'm noticing suddenly, not suddenly, but I'm noticing the bars, I'm noticing the stripes, I'm noticing the spaces in between them in the way I would in one of your paintings. There are clear parallels there. Kelly, one of the things that I wondered about was obviously the conversation started in 2009 when Sean, first of all, had this fresh-faced boy following him around. Then he reads your reading, or your work rather. At what point did you begin to realise that the conversations that you were having were going to form the basis of this book?
Yeah, it's a good question. The idea occurred to me on a number of occasions, but it actually took my editor at Thames and Hudson to propose it in a concrete way. But it is actually something that had been knocking around in my mind that, well, one of the interesting things about talking to Sean, you get a flavor for it here just in the last few minutes, is just how fluid he is, how fluent he is now, how eloquent he is on not only on the topic of his own work, but also just on life and art generally. And that conversation never really repeats itself. It's always renewed. It's always new and invigorated with whatever the context is we seem to be in. And so capturing a bit of that, just cutting off a few yards of that ongoing organic conversation seemed to me a really lovely idea and something I was really grateful we had the opportunity to do.
The book is dedicated, Sean, to your own son, Oisin, and indeed to Kelly's son, Casper, and your own son, Paul, of course, who died so tragically. He features in the book, obviously, your other son, he features in the book as well. But that dedication to the two sons, was that a point of connection as much as the artist and the critic for you?
Well, I just think it's a beautiful thing because what unites Kelly and I is that we are both extraordinarily doting, adoring fathers, and we are the fathers of one son, and that one son becomes, of course, a treasure in our lives, and it has coloured our lives. I think we are both very affected by it, and in fact, in about 45 minutes, I'll be getting into my environmentally responsible electric car and shooting up to school to pick up my son to bring him back to the house where we're going to do our joint French lesson on Zoom.
Well, before you do that, you might tell me about, we'll tweet one further image before we finish up, which is a work called Black Square, very recent work from 2020. I think this work at RTE Arena, if you want to see the image on Twitter, orange, red, a cream, a green, an orange and a red, these wonderful bright coloured stripes in the background, but then this black square, not quite centre, slightly off centre, down towards the bottom of the painting. Just tell us a little bit of the inspirations behind this and what was in your mind, Sean.
Well, you know, I've been making window paintings for a very long time because I always loved the dialectical possibilities of looking at two or three things at the same time in a picture in the way that you can in a Renaissance picture, for example. And I was very affected by the pandemic, as we all have been. My son has probably lost a year of his life, like a war child. And instead of inserting a painting inside a painting, I inserted what I thought was probably a square of denial that's an assault on the painting. So on the one hand, you've got a relationship with nature, which I'm doing in my landline paintings, appropriately titled, and the denial of a view forward, because a window is supposed to be the eye out of the house into the world. In this case, it's the denial of that. Mm. And I think it represents the psychology of perhaps where we have been.
Sean, thank you so much for taking time to be with us this morning for you, or kind of afternoon, I suppose it is with you at this stage, and this evening for us. Off you go now and do your school run. I know you have to do that. And thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. And thanks also to Kelly Grovier and Sean Scully speaking to us about the book On the Line, Conversations with Sean Scully. It's published by Thames and Hudson. Book clubs are back out of their virtual state on Zoom, and not only back in the homes of the participants, but now, thanks to Pan Pan Theatre Company, you can take part in a book club courtesy of the Dublin Theatre Festival. The First Bad Man, Pan Pan's Theatre Festival show, is part theatre piece, part book club, with the audience asked to join in by reading the chosen book beforehand. The book in question is Miranda July's The First Bad Man, and the director of the show, Gavin Quinn, is with me in studio this evening. It was you reading this book that started all of this off. It must have had a fairly strong effect on you, Gavin.
Exactly, yeah. It was about 4 years ago I first read the book, and I really enjoyed it. It was incredibly visceral, amazing characters. Miranda July has a brilliant way to make kind of this weird world, or make ordinary people's lives look extraordinary. So we sort of took the book, read it a few times, met for a couple of years, rehearsed it different ways, developed it, and then we decided, no, we won't adapt this book, we'll make a performance of it. And why don't we like send everyone the book in the post and tell them to come along to a church in Leeson Park for 2 weeks, and we'll perform the book, but we'll talk about the book, and we'll create these characters who are in a book club, and it should feel like you're kind of part of the show. But also that thing of like, people in book club tend to talk about themselves as much as they talk about the book.
Yeah. Before we get too deep into what we're talking about in terms of the form of what you're going to do, just give us the essence of, I suppose, the woman at the centre of the book is this woman, Cheryl. Her situation, where she finds herself as the book starts out.
Okay, yeah. So Cheryl Glickerman is this character, the main character, who's a manager of a self-defence company called Open Palm. And she's having this psychosomatic illness, which is a lump in your throat called a globus. And she's looking for a cure for this. And during this situation, her bosses kind of say, oh, you live alone. Will you look after our 20-year-old daughter, Clee? Because, you know, you obviously have lots of spare time and space. And so she ends up in this very strange situation, relationship with this young woman who tends to kind of almost kind of invades her home. So it's all about that sort of idea of these really strange relationships that can happen, I guess, when other people push them on you. So that's kind of the main characters are these two characters, Clee and Cheryl.
And then the three characters who are the book club members, because I wanted to play a clip of them so that we get a sense of who they are. And they're not just reenacting the book, they're really talking about how they're going to discuss the book even.
Exactly, yeah. So there's three or four characters in the book club. And they've kind of got interesting names like John Benno, Kitty Blennerhassett, Freya Golden. And they essentially meet once in the premise for the piece. They meet for 2 years once a week, and they can't help not discussing this one book. And it kind of shows how this one book invades their lives and takes over, and how they almost become the characters in the book. So they discuss the book, and as a result of the impact of the book, they discover their own sort of their own self, if you like. So we were actually having this sort of double layered thing of there's characters in the book club, and then they become almost the characters in the novel. So it sort of has these two layers that kind of, you know, tells
overlapping.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip then, which is a section where the book club members are discussing one particular aspect of the novel involving a baby. I'll get you to explain the baby idea after this, but they're searching for a safe word so that if the discussion goes off into areas they don't want to go to, then they can find a way of stopping the discussion, and they have to find a safe word to allow that to happen.
The baby. Did you guys say the baby? Jack?
Jack.
I'll pick up a baby in a secondhand shop.
Get a baby.
Get a baby, yeah.
We'd have a safe word, would we?
We'd have to have a safe word because of all the... There's a lot of physical stuff that happens in the novel.
What would be the safe... Could we agree on the safe word now just so we can all get comfortable with it for the next session?
Jeremy Irons, something like that?
That's too personal. I have an association with him.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think Jeremy...
I'm not related to him or anything, but it's...
So either just, way...
It's indisputable that is a safe word.
Look, I know I said we'd agree on everything sometimes, but can we not just have one person who... Look, I think Jeremy Irons is a great safe set of words, and I'd really like to use it, okay? What do you think, Kitty? Could you back me up here?
I'm happy with Jeremy
Yeah,
Irons.
Yeah, I like Jeremy Irons.
If it's ice cream, you might go...
Oh, there's so many words you could choose
toast
from.
Is a classic.
I know.
Toast.
Toast. Oh, my God, I love toast.
Because toast pops out of the toaster, and it's like toast.
Toast is good.
That could be a good safe word.
Something short.
Yeah, one syllable.
Yeah, because by the time you've said Jeremy Irons, somebody might have done something serious.
a clip there from Pan Pan's upcoming theatre show, The First Bad Man, and director of the show, Gavin Quinn, is with me in the studio. And as we heard, first of all, you might tell me who that was, because this isn't the actual cast that we're going to, the people who go to the theatre festival show will see.
So that was the cast of the 360 digital version, which we did in the summer. And that was Luca Costolo is actually in the live version, Dylan Ty and Genevieve Dufresne, but in the live version, it's going to be Andrew Bennett, Judith Roddy, Grace Morgan, and Luca Costello.
Now, my first reaction when I heard this was, I have to read a book just to go to the show. And then I read further and I realised, oh, and there are five shows, all of which are different. So if I want to get the full experience, I have to go to five nights of theatre, one after the other. So just explain, do I have to read the book in its entirety, first of all?
Well, in terms of reading the book, you receive the book in the post, which is like, you know, receiving a beautiful object in the post with a handwritten note which says, welcome to our book club. Please try and read this book before you come to the performance, or try and read some of it. It might help. And also bring the book along with you. So as you know from book clubs, not everyone actually reads the full book. So even if someone reads a page or reads the reviews or even has the object and reads it outside, and even maybe during the performance, if they wish, they can begin reading it too. So that gives you a sense of belonging. But, you know, some people will read the whole book and some people will read a chapter. But even that familiarity with this kind of, you know, physical object kind of brings you into the show. And the show is 5 hours long, but it's 5 separate 1-hour episodes. So you can just go along to 1 hour and that's efficient. Because
yeah, I was wondering, but will it make sense to me if I decide I'm going to go to the second night, for example? Will stuff bleed in from the first night, or is it totally a standalone experience?
It's a standalone experience, but each evening has kind of like a, you know, some repetition, and there is a kind of, obviously the characters are the same, but each evening has a kind of, you know, way of showing how complex a novel can be. And it's all about, really, the whole show is about what we remember. You know, we might read a novel 3 years ago. You might read a novel 10 years ago. I might read a novel next week. And you realize your experiences can be quite different, and how our brain kind of changes things and refocuses things and puts things into light, and how things occur to you. So it's all about that feeling of, like, the book club characters talk about, oh yeah, what was that beginning of chapter 15? I forget, but I think it was about this. And they get things wrong, they get things right, they embellish things, they change things. So it's all about how, you know, by discussing things and how by meeting people, things change. And it is about, I mean, the idea of the show, it's like it's like going to a great installation or a fun performance where you're kind of part of it. So we've kind of rented this church called Wesley House. And so everyone's coming to this lovely church and we're going to hang out for an hour. And it'll feel like sort of, it'll feel strange, you know, and it'll be really kind of exciting to be so, you know, together in a performance.
But in a book club, obviously the whole thing is you want to give your opinion, even if you only have read the first couple of pages, all the more, probably the stronger the opinion you will have on the book that you haven't read. So are you expecting audience members to throw in their ideas and their opinions?
Well, we think the show is pretty fast paced and, you know, it's very funny. It's kind of, it's got a real sense of direction in terms of how it unfolds in the evening. You know, it's not ad hoc. However, we do expect the odd person to kind of, you know, to chime in, or perhaps, you know, make a counter argument, or perhaps I don't know, react. Mostly they'll probably react by laughing, hopefully, and sort of enjoying the kind of jogging the memory of the book they didn't read.
but you do actually enact or adapt. You do adapt parts of the novel and act out scenes from the novel as part of the evening's entertainment as well.
Exactly. Yes.
So this is for the non-readers, really, isn't it?
Well, it's for the non-readers too. No, I think it's sort of like, you know, when you were growing up, you might have read a book like, say, you know, something like War and Peace, and then you see the BBC version, and the actors or the pictures never quite sort of equate to what you have in your mind. So they do sort of role play or sort of enact some scenes, but not very accurately sometimes. But, you know, as people, if they've read the book, then they see something different. They see a different person. And in many ways, the characters look at the people in the book club as characters too. So yeah, you get scenes, but also you get the kind of idea that you know, interpretation is so subjective, and you get a sense of fun about that, and how people get things wrong, and how you don't always have to be. It's not always obvious, you know, who the character, what the character type is.
Mm. The other thing in a book club is one of the great joys is if it's a living author, the living author might actually be part of your, particularly on Zoom. This was one of the great things that happened for book clubs where authors from all over the place could actually be present at your book club if you were doing it on Zoom. Let's have a listen to another clip, which again features the book club members here. Now, this is from that earlier version, the 360 version that you're talking about. This was the 360 degrees. You kind of showed it. It was an online version of the show. And they want to speak to Miranda July specifically. And they have a couple of questions for her. And they're not, let's just say they're fairly forthright in how they express what they want to ask her.
We need to write to Miranda July and go, Miranda, what the fuck? What the actual fuck? What are you doing? Like,
I think if she were here.
What the fuck? Sorry, Rose.
I was just going to say she wouldn't answer that question. If she did come to this meeting, what questions do you think she would answer?
I think she'd happily talk about inspiration, workout tips, sexuality, quirkiness, or like kombucha. I bet she makes her own kombucha.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe she'd give us a kombucha lesson.
There we go. So they really want her to be there. Is she, has she been involved in any way in the adaptation of this? You had to get her permission.
No. We wrote to her, I think, 3 or 4 years ago and said, we absolutely love this novel. I like her short stories, all her work. She's obviously an accomplished filmmaker, visual artist, performer. She's a very eclectic, intelligent, incredibly creative person. And so I wrote to her and said, look, this is the kind of work we make. It's more performance-based rather than, say, a straight play adaptation. And we'd like to make a performance based on your book. And we explained that, we've been making something which is, in and about and around the book and not an adaptation. And so kindly, she gave us permission to do that. And it would be very much our project, because we're obviously riffing off our book and using it to make this kind of unique kind of performance event. So, but kindly she gave permission.
One final question. One of the sets of reviews, a lot of the reviewers at the time of this book, the word quirky was constantly mentioned around the book. I know that she hates that.
She hates that.
Used that term to describe what she's doing. Does that discussion come up?
It does indeed. It's one of the things that we talk about, as people say, if anything's different, they either say that you're eccentric or you're weird, which kind of infers that you're mad, actually. And then, there is that thing of someone says it's quirky, and it's discussed that quirky is kind of otherizing, and it's usually kind of, if a man had said something like that, it wouldn't be called quirky. So there is that discussion around that. It's almost sort of dismissing imagination or anything that's a bit surreal as being essentially unhinged or crazy. And it's sort of an otherizing word. And I think there's a kind of funny expression that one of the characters used, that it's almost quirky, referring to someone as a squeaky doll that you squeeze and it makes a quirky sound. So yeah, there's lots of that.
Fair enough. Well, listen, that's Gavin Quinn speaking to us about The First Bad Man from Pan Pan Theatre Company. It will be at the Dublin Theatre Festival at Wesley House from October the 6th through until the 10th, and on the 13th through to the 17th. You don't have to attend all five, as Gavin has been explaining. You can go to just one and take it from there. Maybe you'll want to go to a second one afterwards. The Rooney Prize, awarded annually since 1976, is one of the most distinguished Irish literary awards. The prize, which celebrates an outstanding body of work by an emerging Irish writer under 40 years of age, is adjudicated by a panel of judges and administered by the Trinity Oscar Wilde Centre for Creative Writing in the School of English in Trinity College in Dublin. This year, Niamh Campbell has been awarded the 2021 Rooney Prize for Irish Literature for her debut novel, This Happy. The Rooney Prize for Irish Literature is valued at €10,000. Niamh Campbell was in with us on Arena in June of last year, June 2020, on the release of This Happy. And here she explains how the River Boyne helped her with the atmosphere of the novel.
When I began the book, I was living with my parents in Mornington outside Drogheda, where the mouth of the Boyne is into the sea. So I was about 5 minutes from the river. You could walk right down onto it. And in the summer, it's very atmospheric down there, because when you have low tide, it's very smelly. It's very, Mornington means town of the mariners. So it's kind of an old fishing spot. So a lot of the texture just came from the fact that I was 5 minutes down the road from that atmosphere. So it was like a field recording. I would go out and I would take in the air, and I got put a lot of that into it. So when I'm reading it now, I can kind of see that those little bits pop out to me, and I remember where they came from. But hopefully they sort of blend in all in one in the book and produce this atmosphere, which feels like a continuous present, I suppose.
Niamh Campbell there speaking to us on Arena in June 2020. And Niamh Campbell has been awarded the 2021 Rooney Prize for Irish Literature for her debut novel, This Happy, which was published by Weidenfeld and Nicol. The Crawford Gallery in Cork is currently hosting two powerful exhibitions of art, one from the 18th century from the great Dutch artist Rembrandt, another from the 21st century from acclaimed Irish artist Brian Maguire. Although thematically very different, both exhibitions show artists focusing on the lives of real people, the trials that they face in life, in all of their mundanity, it could be argued in the case of Rembrandt, and in the case of Brian Maguire, in all of their tragedy. Christine Leach has visited the Crawford Gallery and is in our Cork studio now. We'll start with the Rembrandt exhibition, which is entitled Rembrandt in Print, which gives us a certainly an idea of the medium that's involved here. But before we get into Rembrandt and Prints, just put him in some kind of context in terms of the Dutch Golden Age and the painter that he was, first of all, Christine.
Sure. I suppose Rembrandt is one of those names that people know from art history. And he's very famous as a painter, of course, and regarded as probably the most greatest painter of the Dutch Golden Age. Very well recognised for self-portraits and also for biblical scenes. People might know the painting The Night Watch, or a very famous painting, The Storm on the Sea of Galilee, which people know about because it was stolen from the Isabella Stewart Gardiner Museum in 1990. So that's one of those paintings people know there's a mystery about, it's still missing. So Rembrandt, one of those big names in Western art history, and certainly one of the most significant Dutch painters to have ever worked.
And I use that term, real life. That's kind of one of the trademarks of Rembrandt, is this real life quality, this realism in what he does. Even when we're talking about biblical scenes, the people who we see in the paintings are very much, it's a naturalistic representation.
Well, that's true. I suppose what you see, and in this exhibition, as you said, it's a print exhibition, and so what you see is the line, the draftsmanship. These are etchings and dry points and engravings. So it's what you really see here, which maybe you might not see so much in the paintings, is what a draftsman he was. And he was very, very interested in characters, expressions on faces, bodies, you know. And what you see here are people like beggars on the street, and the nudes that are in this show are you know, real bodies, you know, with fleshy bellies and all of that. So it's not idealised in that way.
Certainly not. Yeah. How important a printmaker was he?
Hugely important, particularly because of he was very innovative, in fact, actually. And what you see in this show, this is a touring exhibition from the Ashmolean Museum at the University of Oxford, and there are 50 prints in this show. There aren't any paintings, it's all prints, and as I said, there are etchings and dry points. Some of them are quite small, some of them are almost like large stamp sized, and what you see is you know, his technique, his abilities, and that thing about the draftsmanship, I suppose, is really important. Really, he's very well known, as I said, for biblical scenes, and there are some great ones here, particularly the nocturnal ones. So you know, really dramatic spotlit images that contrast a sort of moody darkness, and you realise just how much ink he had to put on the plate to get that effect.
We're going to tweet some of the images here as we speak about them as well, and they give a real sense of that realness and that sense of truth that you're talking about, Christine. The Rat Catcher, first of all, from 1632.
That's true.
It does what it says in the tin,
yeah,
doesn't it?
You know, and I think what you realise is that these are from the 17th century. You know, they're really old. You know, Rembrandt was alive from 1606 to 1669. But the characters are very much alive. He was interested in street characters, people that he would see on the street. But you also do get some of those portraits of more wealthy patrons that you would see as well. But even at that, like, there is a portrait in there where he was asked to do it again to make it a bit more flattering, you know. So he wasn't a man to steer away from the wrinkles and the warts.
And in those terms, the making of the prints, how much of it, obviously you have to please the person you're doing the portrait for at one level, but to what extent was he just looking to make a bit of money for himself?
Well, of course. I mean, that's obviously one of the aspects of his career. And he had a very interesting career and became bankrupt as well at one point. So, you know, there's all of that other angle to the art history here, and why his work became well known, not only because he was talented, but also because he embraced the print process. And printmaking was a way of distributing the images, you know, making money and also making a name for yourself, obviously, as well. So, you know, it's interesting to see here some of of those images you might recognise. If you know about Rembrandt's work, you recognise his face because he was very famous for having done these self-portraits. He made more than 40 self-portraits in print and almost as many in paintings as well. But there are some other works here which are really fascinating. Like there's a single still life image which is of a shell, and I've never seen anything like that before. And what's remarkable is how fresh and new it looks. And also what the Crawford has done is worked very hard at giving people access to understanding the technique. So there's a sideshow here which has been put together by the Cork Printmakers, which is a membership organisation in Cork for artists, contemporary artists who are also printmakers or working primarily in print. And that mini exhibition, which is at the side of this show, shows you printing press, tools for etching, and there are videos there as well showing contemporary printmakers using these techniques to make print works now.
The other thing, just before we move off the Rembrandt, is his facility with self-portraits. He was fond of the old self-portrait. How flattering was he of himself? Let's look specifically on at RTE Arena. We'll tweet this image. Self-portrait with Saskia from 1636. How kind or how otherwise was he to himself in these self-portraits?
I think he was actually really curious about facial expressions, you know, and actually really looking, you know, at what the face could do. That image is one of the ones that's being used to promote the show, the self-portrait of Saskia, who is his wife. One of my favourite pieces in the show is a really small little etching. It's like 7 by 2 by 6 centimetres. And it's one that he made when he was 24. It's called Self-Portrait Open Mouthed as If Shouting. So there are images here where, you know, he's deliberately trying to capture something difficult or awkward. His nose is scrunched up and his forehead is furrowed. And what he was really doing was he was learning at that stage when he was 24 how to capture expressions. And of course, the work he did in terms of that would have gone into later paintings. So this is like, you know, practice work for becoming better at capturing those very human expressions.
And as with this second exhibition we're going to talk about, it runs right through until January, so there's lots of opportunity to see that particular exhibition if you're in Cork. But let's move on to Brian Maguire, Christine, one of Ireland's leading artists. What he's doing here is quite extraordinary, remains very much in keeping with this idea that he has in his work about addressing themes of human dignity. What is he talking about? What is he painting about here?
This is a remarkable show, Sean. It's called Remains. These are recent paintings by Brian Maguire, and they are paintings of the bodies of people who have died while trying to cross from Mexico into the USA, and died of dehydration or hypothermia in the Arizona desert. So, as you can imagine, it's a difficult show, and it's really it's hard to spend time with these paintings, but it's a really important and hugely impressive exhibition as well.
Yeah, I saw the catalogue for this exhibition, and I must say, even looking at them on the page of a book is quite harrowing. These are big works.
Yeah, they're large. So I have an image of one in front of me. There are 7 paintings in the show. They're displayed really well spaced out in the upstairs extension space of the Crawford Gallery, so they have a lot of room to breathe, which is important, so you can step back from them, you know. Arizona 1, which is the one I'm looking at a reproduction of here, that is it's an image of a skeleton basically lying in the desert, and it's 146 by 210 centimetres, so they're 2 metres wide, if you can imagine, large paintings.
And again, obviously we can't shy away from the reality of what happens to people when they become dehydrated and die from dehydration on as they're trying to get across the border. But they are so visceral, and they're so... Do we need to see the bodies as close up as we see them in some cases? I mean, I'm looking at one particular painting now of a body like splayed out on the ground underneath a tree. I mean, very upsetting to look at it.
Yeah, they're not easy to look at. And actually, Brian Maguire gave a couple of small talks when the show opened at the Crawford to limited numbers due to COVID distancing. And I was at one of those, and I asked him what is he feeling when he's painting these paintings. And he actually said all of the feeling he has to do has been done before he puts the paintbrush onto the canvas. So he is a painter who has always made very political work. He's painted the victims of femicide and also of the drug wars, of drug gangs in Mexico before. And he said of this, you know, he's now painting the victims of immigration policy. So, you know, this is work with a very strong social conscience. There is an agenda here, and his agenda is to paint and make visible the type of images that don't make it onto the news.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. I want to listen to a short clip featuring Brian Maguire himself. And there's a 13-minute video that accompanies the exhibition made by Mark McLaughlin of Bang Bang Cho. And this is Brian Maguire himself talking about what he believes he's doing with these paintings.
I see what I do as fiction. Sometimes you can tell the truth through fiction better. The truth, of course, here is not a skull found in a desert. It's a human being who was loved, who's disappeared. That's the truth.
That's Brian Maguire speaking about his exhibition at the Crawford Gallery Remains. Finally, Christine, these are two very different exhibitions. Would you see the two of them on the same day, or do they really need space to look at them properly separately?
That's a good question. It's absolutely possible to go and look at them on the same day, although it might be worth two visits. And I would say as well, the Crawford has an amazing array of exhibitions on at the moment, so there's really something for everybody there. Brian Maguire's paintings are worth spending time with, and they may be worth coming back to even again, you know.
Yeah.
I think the Rembrandt exhibition is very much for people who are interested in the technique and the art history behind all of that.
Yeah, I think the Brian Maguire one, certainly you'd want time to pay the dignity and respect that's needed for the people who are portrayed in the paintings.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And we should say that the images come from photographs. He worked with a chief medical officer who has a bank of images, which are photographs of bodies of people who've died in the desert. And his job is to identify and repatriate the bodies.
Yeah.
So Brian worked very closely with those source images to produce this body of work.
All right. The two exhibitions, Christine's been speaking to us, Christine Leach speaking to us about Rembrandt and print. A total of 50 prints there, and remains from Irish artist Brian Maguire, run through until January the 9th. Of 2022, both of them, and you'll find out full details on crawfordartgallery.com. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy Doyle was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1.